his book on Modern Family. We're happy to welcome back our friend Mark Freeman. Hello there, Mark.
Hello, and Happy New Year.
Thank you. Same to you. You've been a busy guy here in the last few months since we spoke last.
This is true. I did a article on the movie The Long Goodbye, which was having its 50th anniversary, with another guest of yours, Josh Karp.
Mm.
And I did a piece last week that I sadly wasn't expecting to do, but then wanted to do, which is about Tom Smothers, Tommy, as he liked to be called, Tommy Smothers.
Well, let's talk about it, because I was such a fan of his, and you did a wonderful oral history of the show several years ago. And well, let's go back to the beginning. Their life story, Tom and Dick's, was an interesting one, enduring some pretty powerful family tragedy when they were just youngsters.
Yeah. They kind of say in that sense, comedy comes from tragedy, or I guess it depends if the comedian has the comedic sense of mind. And the two of them really kind of just formed. They were brothers. They fought all the time anyway, so that would have been part of the act, and in a good way, in a humorous way, that they loved each other. But they kind of rose through the ashes of the problems that they had to form this folk band, really. It wasn't even comedy at first.
Yeah, and had success of playing in the clubs and did albums, and then made that move into a hybrid form of entertainment, combining folk music with comedy.
Yeah, Tommy was telling me a story about Dickie, that Dickie wanted him to introduce the folk songs the exact same way every night, and Tommy didn't want to do that because he kind of felt it was boring, and that in time they created some banter, and out of that banter came the act that you and I remember seeing on television late night and afternoon all the time, which was the You Love, Mom Loved You More aspect, which was Tommy, the straight man, Dickie, and Tommy, the overwhelmed, I don't want to call him a sidekick, the overwhelmed, funny, comedian part of the act.
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting to note, and I guess it's not to be unexpected, because most people simply watch them on TV and didn't look below the surface too much, but I was surprised how many people still think of Tommy based on his persona from the show, but nothing could be further from the truth. In many ways, he was the, I don't want to say the brains of the operation, but he was the mover and shaker in the act.
Yeah, you know, I was listening to, after he passed, some of the conversations we had, and I had a 3.5 hour conversation with him where he went over everything, and that was the longest conversation we had. And one of the things he had said in it, as I was re-listening to it, was and not in an egotistical way, but the show gave him some power to put on acts he likes, power to get skits through that he wanted, power to fight with the networks over censorship, and he really enjoyed having that pulpit to do all that, and missed it when it was taken away, when they were fired by CBS.
They had an interesting opportunity. They had had an earlier situation comedy, My Brother the Angel, where Dick was essentially Dick, and Tommy had died, lost at sea, if I remember right, but would come back and visit. But it was so strange because it didn't play to their strengths. They were rarely together in scenes.
Yeah, they both hated it, to be honest, when they talked about it. Neither really looks back at it fondly. But the ramification of that was that Tommy decided, if I'm ever going to be in TV again with Dickie, we're going to have more control and we're going to have more of a say in what's going on. And the producers who originated the show with Tommy, they kind of came, their view was Tommy and Dickie are these clean-cut, boy-next-door types who are sweet, and they sing songs, and they do funny skits, and will create a show that crosses generations by having older stars like Jack Benny and George Burns, and will blend it with new rock acts like The Who, or Jefferson Airplane. We'll get Betty Davis on there. We'll have this whole round gamut of people, but it'll hit multi-generations, so there's something for everybody. And that's where it started initially, the kernel of what the show became.
And they got that opportunity because Tom embraced the idea of going up against the juggernaut that was Bonanza. So many shows had been canceled trying to compete with it, but Tommy said, look, if we don't do well, that's expected, but if we could somehow do well and even beat them, then we're the hot new thing, and that's precisely what happened.
And it was unexpected. And as you said, no one went up against the Ponderosa. Bonanza beat everything. It was the time slot where other shows go to die. So they had no expectations. They didn't go on thinking they were going to do anything. And they were just as surprised when they got the reaction that they did, which was really a lot of younger kids turning on and tuning in, an unexpected audience, which in a similar way, Titanic, when that movie made $1 gazillion, that was a lot of teenagers watching that movie over and over and over again, and there was money power there in that instance that was unexpected, and in this instance, there was viewing power that was unexpected and ultimately welcomed.
And you talked about the old Hollywood people that they would bring on. But it seems like that was part of who Tommy and Dickie were, too. You know, they grew up in the 1940s and 50s, and they had respect for those older performers. And I think because of that, we're able to get them to come on and play along the way so many of them did.
Yeah, pretty much everybody was willing to play along. There were certain instances where, and you almost wonder how this could happen, but Lana Turner was on, and she had practiced everything, and then realized the night of the show that it's actually live, did not know that, and didn't want to come out of her room. So you would get instances of stars who weren't in their sweet spot, shall we say. But then you get other ones who were willing and were game for anything. There's a long story, which I won't get into, of Kate Smith, the God Bless America crooner you hear at like every Yankees game and a lot of sports games. They wanted to use her in a Laurel and Hardy skit where Tom would be Laurel and Kate would be Hardy, and they were so excited by the skit, and she walked out of the room is basically what happened, because she thought it was a comment on her weight as opposed to what the skit really was. So it was a hit and miss, but a lot of people were just game, and by the time the show became popular, they were more than game. They were dying to be on the show.
We're talking with Mark Freeman here on Downtown. Well, one of the things that stood out with Tommy Smothers, his incredible eye for talent, those musical acts that he booked, but also the group of writers, and he was given free rein to hire that staff, and what a remarkably talented group of people he brought in.
Yeah, so initially, the writers that the show's producers, Saul Ilson and Ernie Chambers, they brought in this mix of writers, some who had written for Jack Benny and the older shows, Lucille Ball or so on, so you'd have that older mentality. And they did bring in younger people, and Tommy's close friend, Mason Williams, he was on the show as a writer. So you had initially that blend, but after the second year, the two producers left, and Tommy no longer had the buffer between like him and CBS, but that also meant he had no one reining him in to hire who he wanted. And so he brought on Steve Martin, who was hanging around a lot and was really eager to do anything and everything that anybody wanted. So he was excited to be added. And then Rob Reiner, he came on, and it was the same thing. And then there were certain instances of certain people who he hired willy-nilly, whose names I won't mention, and probably no one would know them if I did, who bombed, who had no place in a writer's room. So Bob Einstein was there, too, that they found. And so it was this great amalgamation of talent and, again, of Tommy's power, which could be a blessing and a curse.
And they brought in people, too, like Lee French, who so much that she did flew completely over the head of the censors.
Yeah, the censors, obviously that's a long story, and it's a large part of their story when people talk about them. But they would do classic things with censors, like if we put in four jokes, knowing we really only want this one, we'll put in three bad ones that they'll edit out And then we'll get the one in, or we'll subtly make some pot reference, or we'll subtly make some reference to something political, but we'll shape it in such a form that either they won't recognize it, or they'll be so focused on something else that they'll bypass it. And so oftentimes that's how they would get away with material in these skits, such as what you mentioned.
Well, the battles, of course, became epic along the way. Did Tommy sometimes just enjoy the fight, that everything didn't perhaps need to be as big a battle as it became?
You know, looking back at it, when he talks about it, he reflects on it in a humorous way. At the time, he was very strident, and he said once he realized he had this power and this pulpit and this voice, he became very stubborn, which in some ways he regrets, actually. But really, with the censors, more or less, he would threaten to quit every week because something would come up, and he would say, well, if they're not going to let me do this, or if they're not going to do this skit, or I can't use this word, or do this song, like with Pete Seeger, then I'm going to walk. It's not the television I want to do. And so, really, the censors, he actually had empathy for the censor, most of the censor people themselves. They were stuck in this weird position where you're thinking Leave It to Beaver television mentality, but the late 60s is no longer really relevant to that. And so, and there, that makes them somewhat irrelevant to try to balance the 50s morality with the 60s mentality of what should be allowed on television, which led to most of the fights that ultimately led to their getting fired.
One of the most brilliant parodies they did, and it was one that they carried on for a long time, was running Pat Paulson for president. How did he get involved with the show? Did they have a prior history with Paulson?
So Pat Paulson's a really interesting guy, and if people don't know about him, they should look him up online, because he was kind of a performance artist, and he would do very weird, he would do street performance art, he would do just very weird ideas of things, and they needed to do editorials, or well, they wanted to do editorials, let me rephrase that, because that's what was on television a lot in the days, and, you know, Pat kind of fell into that. There, you can even find online, they came up with this idea to run him for president, and he actually got a fair amount of votes in the election, in the 68 election. But there's also online, like, almost an hour, I think it's an hour, presidential campaign introducing Pat Paulson as a candidate, and I believe it's narrated by Henry Fonda.
Oh, it was brilliant. I remember that.
In D.C. Yeah. What did you say?
I remember that. It was a brilliant mockumentary before we even had that term.
Exactly. It was a mockumentary before there was a mockumentary, and yet they got it on air because it wasn't really insulting to anybody, the parody of it all and the politics and the underlying themes, but it was just master television that a lot of people, like I said, don't know about, but you can find it on YouTube, and it is pretty hilarious to watch.
I saw a piece that David Steinberg wrote yesterday eulogizing Tommy Smothers, and in many ways it was that that sermonette that Steinberg delivered that was the final blow for the Smothers brothers.
So that's an interesting point, because there's some controversy about that because some people say, yes, that was definitely it, and some people say no. And when I say some people, these are people associated with the show. So some people point to that as the final straw. Others say, no, that really wasn't the final straw. The network already had their agenda, and it was a useful tool to use to eliminate them from television, shall we say. But if you watch that bit itself, which, again, you can probably find on YouTube, there's nothing really controversial about it. And I know you can also say, well, that's 50 years ago and so on and so forth. But even 50 years ago, there's nothing really controversial about it. It's just, it involves religion. And once you talk about religion, you're already in a danger zone on television.
And there was a change in leadership, too, at CBS. Was it Bob Wood who came in, and he really did not have time to be getting into squabbles with the talent?
Yeah, Tommy, I was listening a little to that today, Tommy, touching on that. You know, like I said prior to, Saul and Ernie would deal with Bill Paley, the head of CBS. They would buffer anything about these controversies and fight for the show. A lot of that stuff unheralded, and then for you get new leadership, and they're like, they don't want to deal with this. Who wants to deal with every week Tommy being upset and you know, threatening to quit kind of thing? Which I say in a sweet way. Tom was very passionate about his ideas, and one of the things that I said to him, I was reading him quotes from people that I had spoken to for that article, like Steve Martin and Rob Reiner, and all of them had nothing but positive things to say about Tommy and how he conducted the show. And Tommy was surprised. He thought that people might, who worked with it, say he was, some of those things, stubborn and angry and so on. But they give credit to their careers to that show and to Tommy's passion for content.
We're talking with Mark Freeman about the late Tommy Smothers here on Dantel. Well, in your dealings with him, because they had a bit of a comeback, CBS brought them back in the 80s, and they continued to tour until they were into, what, their late 70s or early 80s, but never reached that level of popularity they had with the show back in the 1960s. Was Tommy bitter about that, or was he more philosophical?
He wasn't really bitter. I think, if anything, he became somewhat depressed by it all because they couldn't get booked anywhere. They were persona non grata in Vegas. In fact, he said that they could only get booked really in like Tahoe and Reno. So they were blacklisted more or less by the conservative leadership in venues and networks. And so the popularity that they had, first of all, if you're people with the 20-minute memories, if you're not there appearing on television, you're not going to be noticed or remembered. So they had to deal with that aspect of it. And then they can't get anywhere. And the interesting thing, one of the things he said that I thought was really sweet, was his brother, Dickie, as he referred to him, never held it against him. That Dickie said, "Do you know what you're doing?" And Tommy said, "Yep, I do." And he just said, "Go with it." So in a lot of ways, he became a martyr when he never even expected to be a voice. And so that did make him sad. But when he looked back on it and the conversations, I don't think he regretted that. I mean, sure, maybe he regretted losing some of the popularity, but I think the other things that he did were more important, and what he left behind is more important.
I was watching some of the CBS interview they did with the two of them back about a year or so ago, and I was struck by Dickie talking about how the highlight of his life was getting to stand on stage with his brother to his right.
Yeah, it really, at the end of the day, that's who they were. They were brothers. They loved each other. Like I said earlier, yeah, they fought. But one of the things Tommy said, and the producers had also told me, was Dickie was a, I don't know if I want to call him a worldly man, but Dickie had all these things he did outside the show, racing cars and traveling places and different foods, playing golf. He just had a lot of activities. He was very interested in stuff. And Tommy said that Dickie got him to do a lot of things he would have never done for that very reason, because that wasn't necessarily his personality. But at the end of the day, too, when you have two brothers, who else is going to really know each other and know your nuances of how to play towards each other's strengths? And Dickie, from a comedic standpoint, as a straight man, who always are underappreciated in comedic themes, It's his timing and it's his setup that allows the punchline or the humor or whatever you're trying to get out of that particular bit, even if it can seem like he's being abrasive to his brother on stage. Those are characters, and Tommy made a point of that because he talked about a heckler that he had once in Tahoe, and he said he took him out of his character, and I thought that was a very interesting thing to say because he clearly defined what was on stage as a character and not a shadow or caricature of who they were.
In your conversations with Tom and Dick, did you get the sense that they understood their influence and their place in the history of both comedy and television?
Yes and no. Tommy was humble. He said when people would come up that he really admired and they would tell him how important the show was to them, he had no idea what to say. And it, in part, like I say, in the conversations we'd have when I would share things that others had said, it made him very happy because, like a lot of performers, as they get older, they don't perform as much and sometimes feel forgotten. But they weren't. By a lot of comedians cite them as an influence, but Tommy was very conflicted by it because he understood it. He realized that people complimented him for it, but at times he questioned, is that true? Did I really do that? I mean, they say it and it makes me feel good, and so he got something out of it, but I don't know if he always was like on top of the acceptance of how important he was to network television, to comedy, to the era and the counterculture.
I was telling you, we were conversing online, his death really impacted me more than I thought it would. And part of that was because it was a piece of my childhood, but also because from your oral history, your wonderful work, and some interviews I'd seen, I wondered if they understood the appreciation people had for them. And that made me a little sad.
Yeah, you know, I never know when there's somebody that I've interviewed at length and they pass. I never really know how I'm going to feel. There's never anyone that I feel nothing. There's just different emotions and memories associated with it. And Tommy, I was very scared to talk to him at first because I was told he didn't like to talk on the phone much and he didn't like to talk to the press much. And so, but at the same time, here's somebody I saw on my childhood all the time on television, and I was a TV junkie. And so I just didn't know how to approach it or approach him. But he just ended up really being the sweetest man. And afterwards, when you're talking about emotion, and I mentioned it in that tribute article I wrote, about a half an hour after my 3.5-hour first call with him, Dickie called me, and I hadn't been in touch with Dickie. I asked Tommy for his number, and apparently Tommy called Dickie, gave him my number, which is why he was calling, but also told him how good it felt to be remembered and appreciated, and how happy it felt to hear the quotes from the people he had worked with. And to get to give that feeling to someone whose work you really admired and a person who you really admired for what they stood for and what they accomplished in their life. It's not about me, but for me, it was really a very emotional thing. There's been two or three times in interviews where I've had very emotional feelings from either talking to the subject that I wrote about or just in their passing. You never really know, but at the end of the day, everybody in every field, they're people, and we connect to them, and some more than others, and we admire some more than others, and their passing can be tough. Fortunately, in this field, with television and film, their work lives on, and so much is digitized these days and continues to be that we can watch that and enjoy that, and it's always there for us. But it is sad. I had been meaning to call him again recently, and it's one of those things that they say never to do. Don't put off till tomorrow. So I never did get a chance to talk to him again.
Well, read Mark's wonderful tribute. Go back and read his terrific oral history of the show. Mark Freeman, great talking with you as always. Thanks, Mark. Good to have you on with us again.
Great being here. Love being a guest on your show and love your show.
All right. Thank you, Mark. We'll talk again soon.
Okay. Take care.
Mark Freeman with us here on Downtown.